If you enjoy podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Women Physicians Lead, hosted by Dr. Lisa Herbert, helps women physicians move from surviving to thriving in their personal and professional lives. Dr. Lisa shares leadership tips, burnout support, stress management strategies, and inspiration from women physicians who've made remarkable transitions into leadership roles. There's a fantastic episode that you should check out called Taking Care of Yourself During the Journey, about how women physicians can care for themselves while on their leadership journeys. Check out Women Physicians Lead on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mitzi Crockover. Welcome to Beyond the Paper Gown. Prior to the recent midterms of 2022, I hosted a webinar that we called Putting Women's Health on the Ballot, where 11 experts joined me in four separate panels to discuss the various ways that policy impacts on women's health. The panel that follows focuses on the impact of social and environmental factors on health, things like access to healthy food and transportation, as well as fair wages, even climate change and violence against women, and how policy can affect those factors to improve health. We've got Dr. Joelle Abramowitz, who's an economist at the University of Michigan, Linda Goler-Blount, who's president and CEO of the Black Women's Health Imperative, and Dr. Regina Moss Davis, the Associate Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. Thank you all for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So Linda, the other way of thinking about this is what is in the lingo, social determinants of health, or SDOH. And in fact, the AMA came out and said that voting is an SDOH, a social determinant of health. So what does that mean?
Yeah. And it really is. It's, you know, social determinants of health are those many factors that actually impact our health and our health outcomes that have nothing to do with medical care, medical care delivery, or medicine. We've heard them all, things like access to healthy food, a safe neighborhood, housing, where you live, what kind of job you have, access to health insurance. I mean, you know, there's many kinds of these factors, and depending on who you read, medical care is maybe 10 to 20% of what determines our health outcomes. It's not actual care and therapeutics. It's all of these other factors. And there's a historical context for them. These things are deeply rooted in policy. It's the policies that determine housing, redlining, for example. It's the policies that determine whether or not you're going to have a grocery store that serves healthy fruits and vegetables or fresh fruits and vegetables, your education system, what kind of education you have access to. That's a property tax issue. So the things that determine these social determinants are deeply rooted in history. You have to look at 400 years of oppression of Black people, more recently of brown people, immigration policies that determine what people have access to and what kind of choices they can make. And in when we look at sort of the Black woman's experience, there's something called intersectionality, which means we can't actually tease these things apart. It's not just racism or gender discrimination. It's what when these things come together and they are actually justice issues, which then gets us back to policy. And that's what determines all of this. And unfortunately, too often people look at the social determinants of health and say, well, it's just too complicated. There's just too much. There's nothing we can do. And so we don't actually see anything happen.
Well, hopefully we'll change that, especially with the folks on this panel. And in fact, Regina, that's what you do at the American Public Health Association, is look at a number of these factors. Though I do think that a lot of people, when they think of public health, think of diseases, you know, like COVID. But what also COVID did, to Linda's point, is uncovered a lot of issues that have to do with the social determinants of health. So talk a little bit about what COVID did unmask, if you will, especially for women and women of color, and good and bad, and how does policy impact on those issues?
Sure. So women were, as we know, most likely to be exposed to the disease by the simple fact that we're overrepresented, or there's high representation of us in the essential frontline jobs like healthcare, education, the care industries, or the service sectors. But what we also saw was that stress was through the roof. It led to increases in depression, anxiety, and just declines in overall mental health, particularly among women who are primary caregivers or who are the breadwinners in the home. But we also saw that it was particularly acute for pregnant and postpartum women. We're starting to see the research, and studies are showing that women of color, low-income women, members of the LGBTQ community were more likely to experience pandemic-related health challenges. These communities are also historically less likely to have culturally competent mental health treatment, so there was an issue there. We also saw that COVID affected access and use to essential reproductive health supplies like contraceptives. And finally, that COVID really did reduce access and investments in the health, sexual and reproductive health care, maternal health care, but the other essential services that we need. The study is showing that in the US, preventive screenings for breast and cervical cancer dropped 94% following the declaration of COVID in March of 2020. So while we are seeing the screening rates rebound, they remain significantly below pandemic levels. And so what we see is that despite these clear impacts on policy, policymakers still are largely failing to meet the specific needs of women. And so the policy implications continue to be what they were before, which is we need to eliminate barriers, we need more access to, and we need more investments in the care that we need.
And to that point, when you and I spoke, we talked a little bit about telehealth. So that may be the little bit of the bright star in all of this in terms of increasing access. Yet there's legislation, I don't even know where it is right now, even as a physician, when the pandemic started, for those who don't know, telehealth was allowed so that physicians and other care providers could actually provide care across state lines because we're licensed by the states, if you will. And that was a big deal. And also that improved, you know, access when people couldn't get to the, or, you know, absolutely couldn't get to the doctor. And especially with respect to behavioral health, and also paid for it. Like an office visit, when a lot of physicians were really losing money just because they had to close their doors. So where are we now? And where do you think we should be?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because telemedicine was popular both for the providers and the patients, right? It eliminated the barriers to care for women in particular, around transportation and childcare. But it was convenient and popular in terms of you know, being able to fill prescriptions. A lot of times you had to go into the office to do those kind of things. But also for those that don't live close, so it provided the remote access. I would say the polls are largely showing that people are satisfied with this type of interaction and that they want it to continue. And so that's what we hope the legislation will allow for that after the declaration. But there's also, we have to highlight the weak spots, which is that not everyone had the opportunity to access telemedicine. So older women, women with higher educational attainment, insured women, and women living in states that had expanded Medicaid were more likely to have telehealth visits during the pandemic than those that were not. So we really need the telemedicine legislation to continue. We need it to expand, to provide resources, especially for those that are that lack technological access, but those that live in low income or rural areas are those with limited broadband. But also back to that point I made about the access to medication. So we need insurance companies to be encouraged to provide the reimbursement for 90-day rather than 30-day prescriptions, depending on the class of medication, of course. But we need to, again, try to eliminate the barriers so that people can live healthy lives.
Yeah, it's just something so small, it seems, makes such a big difference. And again, it's a policy decision. Joelle, Regina talked a little bit about the impact of lockdown and the fact that people couldn't get preventive services and things like that. Before that, again, another shining star was the Affordable Care Act actually increased access to preventive services. You know, hopefully the lockdown and all of that has been lifted. Women have more access if they have that kind of coverage. So what has the legislation like the ACA or Affordable Care Act meant for women's health, both in preventive services, but also with reproductive health care?
Yeah, so there have definitely been a number of different provisions of the ACA that have really enabled access to care, right? So some of the earlier provisions, you know, enabling young adults to stay on their parents' health insurance up until age 26. You know, that was important, expanding access for coverage for contraception, and certainly expansion of Medicaid. These were huge in, you know, enabling better access to care. You know, in my own research, I looked at the effect of the young adult provision on access to contraception and on abortions, right? And what I found there was that people were, you know, young adults were able to get better care. And as a result, they were better able to utilize that care, right, in their contraceptive use to switch to more effective methods, which resulted in a decrease in the abortion rate.
You know, I just want to underline more effective methods. So before that, less effective methods were covered. You could get access to birth control pills and things like that. But, you know, things like long-term, like IUDs and all of that, not all of that, but more effective contraception. I just wanted to underline that. You know, just really quickly, I think we talked about this in one of the other panels. How are those coverage decisions made? Who makes those and at what level of government?
So really, I mean, you know, obviously the ACA was at the federal level, right? And that was really, you know, I think a great aspect of the ACA is that, you know, we could see, or the goal of it was that we would have this consistent, you know, standard across the country. But we know that that's not actually how things work, right? There's also a lot of variation by state, and in particular with Medicaid, you know, that states were able to opt out of implementing the Medicaid expansions. So we're seeing it both at those federal levels and at the state level. We also, in particular with health insurance, it's also related to employer-sponsored health insurance. And that can vary about state laws related to, you know, what insurers are allowed to provide and employers are allowed to provide. So we're seeing, you know, a lot of variation, and also on the locality level, right? There can be very specific laws related to your city about, you know, different policies. And so, you know, in that way, it's really important to think about all of your elected officials, right? And all of these policies, because it's not just at one level.
Sure. And one, you know, glaring example is what's called the pink tax or the tampon tax. That can be city or state, correct?
That's right. And, you know, where I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I think it was the first state to, or not state, the first locality to require that private businesses provided free menstrual products, right, in restrooms. And so, you know, that's something that's very specific to our locality. Other localities have done similar types of laws, but even, you know, on a very small level, these can really vary. And it's something to be aware of when you're looking at, you know, local ballot proposals and things like that.
Yeah. And Linda, you gave me a really startling statistic when it came. Why is that so important? Why is just something like, you know, it sounds cute, a pink tax or a tampon tax, and it's not cute at all?
No, it really isn't cute, Minty. I think some people listening to this call might be shocked to learn that menstrual products are considered luxury items in certain states. I guarantee you, if you're a person who needs menstrual products, you don't think of them as luxury items at all. And so in some states, they're taxed at the level of luxury goods, like a Mercedes-Benz. And what we've found in our work with working with high school students, young women in low resource schools, is that they are missing 1 to 2 days a month from school because they can't afford menstrual supplies. And that those 1 to 2 days a month are enough to derail their entire high school career. And so the officials here in Georgia and in the Atlanta public school system say that roughly 20 to 30% of the reason young girls don't graduate high school and then go on beyond that is because of the number of days they lose because of menstrual insecurity.
So just to add to that, because Joelle, you talked a little bit about this on the Aftershocks webinar, and just very briefly, you were one of the signatories on the amicus brief for the Dobbs versus Jackson in support of Jackson with respect to the effects of not being able to access abortion care and the economics of that. So can you quickly just summarize what that meant in terms of the economics? That again goes to Linda's point as well in terms of these issues really making a difference.
Absolutely. You know, I think really the fundamental argument that that we were making in that brief was that, you know, by not providing, you know, these sorts of rights, then women don't have the full opportunity to participate in, you know, the economic and social, you know, environment of our country. You know, if they can't make decisions to decide about their education, their work trajectories, these sorts of things, then we will see effects, right, on their own educational attainment and work trajectories, on that for their families, right, their communities, and for the economy overall.
Thank you. And that, again, the economy overall, it hurts everybody in the long run. And I thought that was very impactful. And then speaking of the workforce, Linda, talk a little bit about the Fair Work Initiative that Black Women's Health Imperative is focused on and why that's so important, again, to everyone as well.
Yeah, it really is. A few years ago, we conducted a study and we asked Black women to sort of name the number one health issue for them. And not surprisingly, it was stress. Dr. Davis Moss already alluded to it. Stress is the number one issue. The workplace was the number one source of that stress. And to put a finer point on that, you know, we celebrate or acknowledge Women's Equal Pay Day every year. Well, this year, Equal Pay Day for Black women got pushed back 6 weeks. So it now takes an additional 6 weeks to earn what their white male counterparts earn. But because of the role of the workplace, we created Fair Work, which is a workplace initiative that looks at over 350 metrics to help employers understand what a fair workplace would look like and what the benefit is to them. We're moving well beyond the traditional DEI approach because, again, we've got about 25 years of literature and data that show that DEI hasn't really worked all that well, hasn't achieved its objectives. And that's because of the way it was crafted. Basically, it became white men's responsibility to do something to or for people who weren't white men in the workplace. And so everybody was aggrieved. So with Fair Work, we create strategies to get to fairness. And people may not know what equity is, but they know what fairness feels like. And we know if we can create a fair workplace, then employers reap the benefit. I mean, we can already draw a line to top and bottom line revenue and improved earnings per share and corporate performance. But importantly, it gives not only Black women, but all women data and strategies to make the best decision about where they might want to work or not want to work and what they can expect from that workplace. And if we can use the data that we get from this, which we will certainly try to really push hard on equal pay, we know that the single greatest contributor to improving health outcomes for all women is just being paid what we should be paid for the work that we do.
It's that simple?
You know, it's amazing how being able to afford things actually matters to your health. And so we're really excited about that. We've got three organizations with a total of over 100,000 employees who are going to start with us out of the gate. And so stay tuned and look for the results, because I think it'll be really informative.
Terrific. Thank you. And we are always running out of time. I want to also ask Regina this one question as well. You talked a little bit about things I didn't really think about when I thought about women's health and legislation. So very briefly, migration and the built environment.
Sure. Well, I'm trying to do that briefly, but
I know. Which would take at least a whole day, right?
Yes. Talk about it in the context of climate change, which is basically that it's no longer, I'm glad that people aren't looking at it just as polar bears, but It really does increase women's health risks, and it really does compound our pre-existing vulnerabilities. But I talked about it both in a domestic and a global perspective. And so from a global perspective, climate change will produce an estimated 200 million global refugees. And so when natural resources become scarce due to climate change, girls and women are going to travel to find secure water, food, and whatever else they need. And so that increases their risks for sexual abuse, gender-based violence, disruption in sexual and reproductive health services, and more. Happy to talk more about it, but that's one aspect of it. And just, you know, of course, there's environmental exposures, increased risk for things like low birth weight, preterm birth, when you have, when you're exposed to things like extreme heat and particulate matter.
And then you talked about, again, environmental issues like not having access to clean water, for example. But going to your point, thank you for the segue, and this is my last question for you all. I can't leave this conversation without talking about maternal mortality. We've alluded to it a little bit in some of the other panels, but it's a travesty that in the United States, it has one of the worst mortality rates for pregnant women than in any other developed country. And we know that Black women are 5 times more likely to die. We know that violence against pregnant women is a significant issue. So if you can, you know, paint what you would like to see happen in this next legislative session to make those numbers better, what would it be? And Regina, I'll start with you.
I mean, we need to stop committing violent acts against women, that in and of itself, but that has to do with power, gender, and the value of how we are perceived in society. I'm going to just touch a little bit on the policy piece of this, and just to give the space to my colleagues who may want to answer this, but we saw increases in during COVID. You know, anytime we have issues around poor coping strategies, those are associated with various forms of gender violence. There has been the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women's Act, which has been critical in providing services to survivors. We need to continue to do things like block grants to those critical organizations that are providing services around sexual assault. They can help with the legal help, but they can also help navigate the system. I do know that the United States at the Generation Equality Forum had made some commitments around preventing and responding to gender-based violence. The American Rescue Plan creates a safe leave for gender-based violence survivors. So these are women who are fleeing domestic and intimate partner situations, but we need to do more in this space. And it really does start with how we value women.
Absolutely. Joelle, do you have anything to add?
I would certainly echo what Regina just said. You know, I'll add, focusing on the piece about maternal mortality more broadly and how we should think about that going forward. One thing that's always struck me on more of the research side is that we don't have great data about maternal mortality. There are issues about how it's collected, if it's been consistent over time or consistent across states. And it makes it really hard if we don't have the data to be able to understand, you know, what are different drivers and how do we address them and how do we implement policies. So I would, you know, emphasize that we need to start there to really think about some good evidence-based policies that we can implement.
Thank you. Linda.
Yeah, and I certainly echo my colleagues. What we see is also a symptom of the fractured society that we live in, of incarceration policies that started with the Reagan administration, and what happens when you have policies that put men in jail, and then when they get out, they can't vote, they can't be employed, and there are no supports in place. And to Dr. Abramowitz's point, maternal mortality review committees don't exist in every state. They don't collect the same kind of data. They don't have the same composition. So even with the data that we have, we're not making good decisions, but we don't actually have enough data to fully understand what is going on. But if we do know that if everyone had had a living wage job, that would go a long way to eliminating violence at of all levels, and particularly violence against women. And if women had equal pay, I'm going to come back to that, then we could get ourselves out of those kinds of situations. But women make choices that make perfect sense to stay because they have to, and it's understandable, but we need to change society so that we don't have to make those very difficult decisions.
We'll have to let that be the last word for this panel. Thank you all so much, and hope to have another conversation, a longer one, another time. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our podcast is produced by Patrick Shambayati and me, and our associate producer is Kyla McMillian. Until next time, be well.